Hello, this is the third episode, part of the Global Sheep Forum Next Generation Program. The program is about building the capacity of young sheep farmers around the world and helping them develop their skills and network globally and hopefully inspiring other young people to enter the sheep industry. Today's episode with Rich covers just that, how he started out and how he's building his business and herd. He is a farmer from England, and I love hearing these stories of how these young people are so committed to becoming farmers and are doing everything it takes to get there. Thank you so much for your time today. So as we've just discussed, you are a part of this Global Sheep Program. So tell us three words to describe yourself.
As I was saying, I was struggling with this one. So I asked my wife and she came up with driven, organized, and sociable.
So tell us a little bit before we get into the hard-hitting questions as to how you ended up here on a podcast with me today.
I ended up here because I'm obviously part of the Next Generation Ambassador scheme, and Kate asked me, well, she asked the group if anyone wanted to do it, and me and Emily both said we'd do it. So that's about it, really.
And what's your program? So your sheep program over there, or your Next Generation, what do you guys do?
Yeah, so there's 12 of us on it from Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and England. And we meet four times a year for 3 days, go to different sheep farms, went to a livestock market last time, and just loads of different consultants for grassland. And we did a bit of benchmarking last time and just various things like that that'll help us with our businesses, really.
And where are you today? So where are you from? Where are you recording here?
I'm in Rothbury, Northumberland, right at the top of England. We're about 32 miles off Scotland. But I'm originally from Yorkshire. We moved here about a year ago now. We moved to a new farm last year from Yorkshire to Northumberland.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about your farm and your enterprise, who's part of that. And that's really cool, moving to a new place. How did that come about? I hear it's quite tricky over there to sort of move up in the farming world and grow property size. So tell us a little bit about that process.
Yeah, it is hard to get into. And I think sheep, that's sort of how we ended up getting into sheep, because it's probably the best thing to start up with. I bought 20, because my parents are farmers, so I bought 20 ewe lambs with lambs at foot in May 2015. And then just started renting loads of bits of land here, there and everywhere around home. And we were quite spread out. Then me and my wife got together about 4 years ago, and we really started ramping up the numbers. Then we had about 800 ewes back in Yorkshire, and then we had 2,500 pigs on a contract finishing agreement, and about 100-120 store cattle. But we were so spread out, we were like driving 30 miles between blocks of grazing and stuff. So we'd applied. This was actually the fourth farm we'd applied for, because every farm that comes up, there maybe be 30 people put in for it. So it is quite competitive. But we were really lucky with this one, because we did, it's called a Henry Plum Foundation Scholarship. And with that, you get a mentor. And our mentor was in Northumberland, called Duncan and Gus Nellis. And they have the same landlord as us, as one of their farms. So they, their landlord had approached them and they recommended us for it. So it was quite good. We came up here and met them last April. And then we moved here in June last year. And it's made our life so much easier, because this farm's all in a ring fence. It's about 580 hectares, just all in one block. And there's myself and my wife, Jen, in partnership, Traders R&J Oglesby. But Jen works full-time off farm as like a farm trader, dealing in seed and grain and fertiliser. But we have a full-time shepherd called Barney, who's 21, and he's a really good lad. So me and him do pretty much all the work here, just the two of us. And any sort of like tractor work, we generally use contractors for and try and just do all the livestock stuff ourselves. We do little bits of tractor work ourselves, but mainly all contractors for reseeds and baling and silage and stuff like that.
So explain it to anyone listening who might not understand how it works over there. When you so you talk about renting, so you started off renting. So would that be the equivalent of, say, Australia, like a gisting sheep on a property? And then how do you apply? Because it's again very different to say where I'm from here in Australia. We don't what talk about that process.
Yeah, so how we started off in Yorkshire, we were just took on little bits of grassland, and it was very much just word of mouth. We didn't have an agreement or
Who
anything
do
like
you
that.
rent
And
off?
most of ours were sort of like retired farmers with a little bit of grassland, or there might be a big arable farmer that had a bit of grass but wasn't interested in having any livestock. There were mainly things like that, or like things in. They call them HLS agreements, higher level stewardship agreements for like environmental. And we could only graze them from April till October and things like that. So it took a bit of working out and moving around. And then this farm.
Why is there such a restricted grazing area? What is that to conserve?
So, because we have quite a lot of, it's probably quite different in Australia. We had some Kiwi friends come and stay with us for a week last week, and we kept telling them about all these grants and schemes and everything, and they couldn't believe it. They actually started taking the mick and saying, "Who's this grant you keep talking about?" Because they've structured it quite so everyone used to get like a payment per hectare just for sort of food production kind of thing, like a support payment. Which I don't think you guys get, do you?
No.
But they're taking that away now, and they're replacing it. You can get sort of like grants for sheep handling systems, putting them in, or like you can get them for putting herbal lay, sort of things that help the environment, or like not, you can get them for not putting fertilizer on paddocks and stuff like that. So these ones that we used to graze, part of their scheme was that you weren't allowed livestock on it at certain times to help wildlife. So there's quite a few of them around. We haven't actually got any of them on this farm, but some people do. But yeah, that's what we were doing in Yorkshire. And this farm, we're actually on a joint venture, like a share farm. So it's in a contract farming agreement. I don't know if you have them over there or not. But so basically, we're technically the contractors, and then the family we do it with are called Michael and Sam Ord, and they are the farmers, and we farm the farm for them, but we also own the sheep, but the Ords still own the cattle, and we have red deer on the farm as well, and they own the deer, and then it's a brilliant opportunity for us because we can sort of build up over the time and buy more and more stock and equity in the business. Which is things like that are hard to come by, but they're a fantastic opportunity for someone like us to build up without having to borrow loads of money at current high interest rates.
It's interesting. I interviewed a farmer from Ohio. Same thing. He was trying to get trying to build up. I think we sometimes associate farming with intergenerational farms, but yeah, it's not as common as what we think nowadays. It's a lot of people trying to work out how to do it, starting from nothing, sort of building their way up. So it's really interesting that you were able to get your foot in the door and shows the power of networking. You got that contractor through networks. So people should definitely sign up to programs and opportunities like this program, I suppose.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I don't think you can, if there's one thing that we've learned in our time is you can't do enough things like that, and you can't meet enough people because you just never know when an opportunity will come up. Like it might not be straight away, but they might just get back in touch 2 years later and something will come up. And the majority of our business has been built up like that. Like you might ask someone to rent some land off them at the time, they'll say no, but they'll remember and come back to you in a year or two. That's happened a few times.
So you're saying around Yorkshire, it was a lot of older farmers with smaller plots of land. So do you need more land and more sheep now to survive? Is it's similar to Australia, how properties are growing, family businesses have to sort of get bigger, really. And I'm presuming it's picking up their similarities in that over there.
Yeah, I think that in the future in this country, with losing the payment I was saying about, I think historically there's been like, and especially where we were from in Yorkshire, there's a lot of like 300 acre owned family farms. But I do think economies of scale are going to make a massive difference going forward. And there is quite a lot of bigger farms in Northumberland, I'd say, like one of our neighbours' farms, about 6,000 acres. And there's quite a lot of big farms around here. So we've got a better scale now. We've got about 2,000 ewes, 100 cows, and 100 red deer hinds, which has made it so that I can be on the farm full time before. Because in Yorkshire, we're doing the sheep and cattle and pigs, and still helping other farmers out and stuff like that. But yeah, I do think that a lot of these smaller farms back in Yorkshire, I imagine in 10 years' time, like they'll all be farmed. Like 10 farms will be farmed by one farmer, and the others will maybe just live in the house and do something else. So, I think we will. I think we have seen that, and I think we will probably see more of it going forward as well.
So, would you say it's a challenging time? I suppose it sounds like it over there for you guys. What would the biggest challenges be? One, trying to start out, and two, just as an industry in general.
Yeah, I think it is definitely changing times. And I've seen when we were looking for tenant farms like 4 years ago, there was hardly anything came up. But now there's so many opportunities appearing around with this payment going. Like we actually think it's a good thing the payment's going, because there was a lot of sort of older farmers or people just sort of living off the land, getting the payment and not really pushing it, not striving to actually have a profitable sheep, beef, arable farm, whatever it might be. So I think a lot, so some people have seen that change is obviously going to happen, and they're either renting their farms out or selling them, or like there is a lot of opportunities coming up. Like I think this joint venture opportunity we've got, I probably think that wouldn't have come up if it wasn't for the payment going. And challenges, yeah, I think the payment going will affect a lot of people, but the way because we've always just rented bits of grass, we've never actually had the payment anyway, so we've always sort of had to make a profit out of the sheep and cattle. But yeah, I think that will affect a lot of people. Other challenges, probably pressure from general public to sort of the environment sort of things, in carbon neutral, the animal welfare side. I think there's pressure on tail docking and castration at the minute on the sheep side. I think we'll definitely see some changes in that in my lifetime. I think lamb prices, we've had like a record year for lamb price over here this year. I don't know what it's been like in Australia, but we were selling lambs last February and March 23 for about £4.90 pence per kilo of lamb, whereas this year it's been up at sort of £7.80, £8 a kilo. It got up to £8 a kilo, so it's not far off double. And then we've just been doing some budgeting for this year yesterday, and we sort of think we'd probably be £6.50 a kilo for lamb, which will be 19 kilo carcass. You're looking around £120 a lamb after knockoffs, which is, I think last year we only averaged 88. So we've seen quite a big increase the next year. Whether or not it'll continue, I don't know.
Where do you think that's stemmed from? Is there, because I understand your main market over there is a domestic market. So where do you think the cost of lambs, where the increases come from? Just lack of
Yeah, I think it's
those
supply
farms?
and demand. Like, yeah, There's less the breeding ewes in the UK is always dropping down a bit, and there was a predicted lower kill. I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but I was reading something the other day. There's a predicted lower amount of lambs in last seasons that were going to get killed, and then we've had a really wet spring, so there's probably going to be less lambs again this year. So I think the lambs are just not there, and we're very lucky in this country that we have such a massive population. So we have a good customer base right on our doorstep. But I think, again, I can't remember the official stats, but I think 50% of our lamb is exported into Europe, so France, Germany. So we do have a big export market for the lambs, and I think that's what really pushes the price up. But it does get a bit worrying when it gets too high that people stop eating lamb and move to something else. So,
Absolutely.
yeah.
And with the subsidy, so the subsidy that the payment, how did it work? So if you were renting, you said you were renting your sheep or renting it, you didn't receive the subsidy. So does that farmer still receive the subsidy when it was about? And do you know where the subsidy stemmed from? How did that come about being a thing?
So probably when I was really little, 25 years ago, 20 years ago, I can't remember when it changed, but they used to have called an IEX payment, and it was like a headage payment for the amount of sheep or the amount of cattle you had. You got like a headage payment. I don't know what it was per stock unit. So farms had quite a lot of stock on them back then because they were getting paid a headage. And then they changed it, yeah, maybe 20, 25 years ago to, they called it the single farm payment. So it was just a payment per hectare. Can't remember off the top of my head what it would be, maybe 100, 100, maybe 200, 150, £200 a hectare, something like that. And yeah, so landowners would get that, or if you were on a long-term tenancy, like a generational one or a 15, 20-year one, you would get that, and you would have to buy the entitlements. So you would have entitlements to claim that payment. But because we were just on like yearly grazing licenses, the landlords used to keep that and the rent. So we never seen any of that before. And yeah, we were just having to make it pay off having the sheep, and I think that's what sort of funneled us into the extensive system. Like for this country, we call our system an extensive system. Like everything's lambed outside. There's no hard feed to the sheep. The cattle are outwintered all the time, which is probably pretty standard for you in your country, but over here, there's a lot of lambs are creeped and lambed in sheds inside. Cows will be inside for 6, 7 months over winter and put back out to summer. A lot of cost and a lot of machinery. And we tried to cut those sort of fixed costs out and get rid of machinery. We just run one tractor and sort of minimal machinery as we can. And we outwinter the cows on bale grazing or deferred grazing. Sheep, we'll put in some forage crops and outwinter them on that, or just manage to rotate them round. We do a lot of rotational grazing here, which isn't there's quite a lot of good farmers doing it now, but it's not that common in a lot of places. They're sort of set stocked, and but I think all these things are probably starting to change and going to change. You see more of now moving to sort of what I would call the New Zealand kind of system of farming.
And what's your lambing rates? Yeah, if you're lambing outside, did you see a big change? Well, compared to say people around you who are lambing in a barn?
Yeah, so there'll be a variation around the UK. Sort of hill farmers up on the high hill will only they'll be sort of fairly happy with 1, 1.2. Because they struggle to rear more than that on the hard hill. Whereas some people on the lowland, lambing inside, and like they'll have pretty productive lowland sheep. They'll want to be aiming to scan at 200% and try and rear 1.7. And we're what we call an upland farm, so we're sort of in the middle. We're not high hill, but we're not lowland. So we sort of aim for 1.75, 1.8 ideally scan, and try and rear 1.5% per ewe to the ram. But we are back a little bit from that this year. I think just with moving farms, we've had a few things that we wouldn't normally expect, and the sheep are just taking a little bit time to adjust. So I think we'll be probably hitting like a 1.4, 1.35 weaning this year, which is a bit back from where we used to be. But still, if you like, we've not got the costs that some of them indoor people have. But we just hit a few problems on this farm we didn't used to have on our old one, like ticks. I don't know if you've heard of ticks. They're like getting the rougher ground, and we had tick-borne fever in the ewes. We had about 15, 20 ewes abort
Yeah, right.
due to being bitten by the ticks, which they weren't like immune to it because they'd not come in contact with it before on our old farm. Whereas going forward, as they become acclimatized to it, they should be better.
So did you just have to let that play out then? So there was nothing you could do to interfere at the time, to intervene, sorry?
No, well, you can't vac there's not a vaccine for it. The
Yeah, that
only
would have been quite stressful for you though. Going out into the paddock and seeing all your ewes, being like, oh my gosh, all my ewes are boarding.
Yeah, well, we had a few more than normal abort. Like, we'd always expect a handful, but we had a few more than normal. So we got the vet out to do the blood tests, and it came back with that. And I was almost a little bit relieved that we hadn't picked up some sort of disease going through the flock that we couldn't get rid of. So it was almost actually a bit of a relief that it was that. And then we had a few more, like, come to the end of lambing, just lost their lambs earlier on, and we'd not seen after scanning.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be ticks as well. So it could have been worse, but I think the vets advise that this year we just run them over the rougher stuff up on the hill in like September before they're in lamb. So they get bitten then when they're not in lamb and get a bit of immunity. And we probably just have to do that every year going forwards.
Yeah, right. What breed of sheep did you say you had and why?
We are in a bit of a conversion stage at the minute. So the sheep that used to be on this farm, they had Scotch Blackface and mules. The Scotch Blackface, like a hill sheep, and they would like traditionally they would have a stratified sheep system in this country. So they would start off with a hill sheep, then they would breed what they call a mule over here, and then that would go down to the lowland. So yeah, there was about 1,400 mules and about 450 Scotch Blackface on here, but they were not like the hill ones weren't even weaning one lamb a ewe. So we've sort of replaced them with cows, and we have cows on the hill and use that for wintering cows outside, and they've all gone. And then the old flock of mules here, because they weren't breeding their own replacements on the hill. They were buying in every year. They'd picked up disease called OPA. I don't know if you've heard of that, and a couple of other things. It's sort of like a disease that affects their lungs, and they almost sort of like drown in their own saliva kind of thing and
Terrible.
die. So yeah, we did some tests and found they had that in them. So we've had to keep them fully separate from the flock we brought up. And we're quite lucky that this used to be four farms and it's split by a road. So we've had their old flock on the farm at the other side of the road, and all our new stock have come here. And the old flock should be all going after weaning this year. But it's made life more tricky than it could have been, because we've had to keep everything separate, like even needles and drugs and different trailers and different handling systems, and it's made it quite complicated.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have managed, touch wood, and the sheep we brought up are Clyn. They spell double L YEN, they're a Welsh breed, but we also started crossing New Zealand Romney on them, so they sort of have our own sort of composite of Clyn, New Zealand Romney sort of cross. But we've actually just decided last year, we've ummed and ahed about it for quite a while, and we're gonna try and go to all wool shedding, so they're all shedding sheep. And we've just bought a few Easy KUs, and I think this year we will buy a load of EasyCare rams and put them all over all of our nucleus and aim at breeding all the wool off our sheep, because it's just such a massive cost for us, and you get nothing back. Like they keep dropping the wool price every year, and it's costing a fortune to it costs £1.60 to shear a sheep, and then you've got all your time of bringing them in, sorting them, having the labour there for the day, pushing them up and wrapping the wool, and it's I don't even think you get a quarter of the cost back from it.
What
So
so wool market wise, what's there then? Just nothing.
yeah, we do have the British Wool Marketing Board, which is quite a historic, I don't know how long they've been around, for a long time, who market the wool, and all of ours gone there for years, but it just keeps going down. They just don't seem to have the demand for it anymore. I think it's just being replaced by, plastic material kind of stuff, and it's just not popular anymore. So there has been quite a big movement here. There's quite a lot of people are moving to the wool. Well, not a lot, but there's quite a few. It's becoming more and more popular, people moving to Easy Cares or wool shedding sheep or Ex-Lanas. And I
I
think
do
that's good.
pick Easy Care. That would have been a big decision, but which breed to go with?
We something we've thought about for probably 3 years, and we kept thinking about it, and we nearly bought a load of tups last year, and then we entered an NSA competition and won two New Zealand Romney rams, so we sort of just went with them because they were free. But yeah, I think with the Easy Care route is going to be the most profitable for us. Our goals have sort of changed. We always wanted to be selling rams like Clyne rams and whatnot for breeding, and now our sort of aim is just to shepherd as many sheep as easily as we can and maintain a work-life balance. And I think with the Easy Cares, me and Barney could quite happily shepherd 3,000-4,000 ewes and not be too stretched with it, because there's not the need for tailing at lambing time. No shearing, no crutching. Probably be debatable whether or not we need to put fly protection on. I know some people with them do, some don't. So we'll probably just have to assess that when we're there. But I think that is going to be the future for us. We only bought a few 35 just to try this time, and we didn't have to lamb any of them, and we didn't have to tail them, and the lambs are growing just as well as the ones that we've got in the others. So I can't see why we wouldn't do it. So that's the way we'll end up going, yeah.
So long-term goals then. So it's interesting you say it's changed even, I suppose, in the short amount of time you're farming. But do you want to own your own property at the end? Is that what the long-term goal is, or what are you guys working towards?
That would be a goal, but I can't imagine it be a very ambitious goal, because land prices here are crazy. Like
What are they? What are you looking at paying?
just it varies a lot. There's actually a big estate for sale next door at the minute, which is 13,500 acres, and that's just over £35 million. But that's at per acre, that's actually fairly cheap compared to what it would normally be. But obviously, we'll never ever have 35 millions in our life. But even next door, there's like a 50 acre, little 50 acre farm with a house and a couple of sheds with it. And that's on for 1.1 million. It's just crazy. So our goal really is our sort of short-term goal is to own all the livestock on this farm and all the cattle, and a few, we'll have a few more sheep to buy this year, and then we'll own all of the sheep here this year. Yeah, just to fully stock this farm, and then it'd be nice to take on another one if it came up not too far away, and just get our economy of scale a bit better still. But I imagine it'd be nice, hopefully, if the opportunity came up when we own all the stock on this farm, to move from a contract farming, share farming agreement to being on a tenancy to re just rent it outright ourselves.
How does
And
that
then
work?
if we
As you mentioned before, there's like long-term tenancies, which were like 30, 40 years or whatever. So how does that work?
Yeah, so they're very rare. Now you occasionally see, so there used to be a oh, I can't remember what they're called. So there used to be like a generational tenancy. So you would either get it for one generation, or quite a lot of them were 3 generations. I've got a few friends now, they're like the third generation on that farm, so they'll be the last generation. But more common these days is an FBT, a farm business tenancy, and they'll quite a lot of them are only 5 years. You do occasionally see ones for 20 to 15 years, but because there is so much change in the industry here at the minute, I don't think people are as keen to put them in for a long time. So you tend to see shorter agreements. Like we only have a 5-year agreement on this farm. And hopefully, I can't see why it wouldn't roll over, but you never know, because you don't have it in writing. So we are sort of like, we have invested in lime and improving the soils and the farm, but is always a little worry in the back of your mind that you might be moving somewhere else and starting again in the future. But
You know why?
hopefully.
Like even the long-term generational tenancies, there's I suppose an element of that where you have to be quite selfless. Like, okay, I'm planting this, but it might not even be for my own kid, or I'm investing this into the soil. But it's interesting.
Now, how would that work in Australia? Do you have long?
I'm on a family farm, so I've been there. I'm the fifth generation from my property, and we own it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like succession for anyone you talk to, I think succession's always a really tricky topic as to like how that property is passed down, and that has changed a lot. Traditionally, it used to be fa like father to son, and then we're seeing a lot more women coming through now as farmers and that sort of thing. But it's getting trickier, and I think land prices being worth more, makes it even trickier again, but it's always tricky. But there's different like leases. So you'd lease a farm, so that's to crop it or whatever, or you'd adjust your property, oh, your sheep, sorry, on a property. So it's very, there's like some of the stations, there's pastoral leases. So that can be like a longer term lease, like 30 years. Oh, I don't know, that varies. But yeah, I feel like it's even more complicated again over there. Compared to here, I don't know, it makes it seem easy really here.
Yeah, like I said, there's a few years back, it would be very rare to hear of a share farming agreement, but they're becoming more common now. One of our friends is just starting a dairy farming share farm agreement, and all these opportunities starting to come up, which I think is a really good thing for this country, to get some new ideas and new people coming into the industry.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It sounds like, as you say, you got your foot in the door because of it. But 5 years is a tricky amount of time. 3,000 sheep. Do we invest into soil like lime? I don't know how much you pay for it over there, but it's expensive here. There is those decisions. I suppose that does add an element to it. Yeah, but it sounds like it's quite uncertain as an industry overall if a lot of people only want those 5-year agreements and not looking for the 30-year. Sounds like a bit of a moving beast, the ag industry, for you guys.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think the people that are looking for the farms, I think they, like our side, like us, we would want a 20-year one, but I think it's the landlords, like they don't, because there's like big payments for tree planting and things like that. So a lot of them, they're not wanting to put a rent out with a sheep farmer for 20 years when they might
A better
next
offer.
year, they might
Yeah.
out. payment for something. I think that's partly it. And even a lot of the some of the 15, 20-year tenancies we'd applied for, when you actually read into it, they all have a 5-year break clause. Every 5 years, there's a break clause anyway. So they're really not much more than a 5-year agreement as well.
That's interesting. Now, well, you spent some time in Australia. So, what were the biggest differences, or did you see comparing the two sort of countries to farm in? And what can we learn off you guys? And what did you sort of pick up from us?
Yeah, I think so when I went out there, I didn't actually, I think I just bought them first 20 sheep, so I didn't have much back home. And I wanted to do something a bit different, so I went to Australia and New Zealand for a little bit, but I didn't actually do a lot of sheep farming. I worked on a big 25,000 acre arable farm, drove a combine over there. And a few other bits and bobs. That was extremely different, just to see the scale and the size of the farms over there, and the remoteness as well. Like, you're driving 45 minutes to get a loaf of bread and stuff, whereas you just don't have that over here. Like, everyone's so close together. And I'd worked on a beef farm over there, and the big thing. And then I went to a farm in New Zealand that had 40,000 sheep and 2,000 Angus cows. And yeah, the beef farm in Australia that had 1,000, 2,000 Angus cows. And it was just the scale and the extensiveness of it, like everything outside. Not really seen that before. Like, it's just so common over here. Like, as soon as we got this farm, everyone back home was saying to us, "Has it got a load of sheds? What are the sheds like?" Because that's just ingrained in people over here that livestock have to go in a shed over winter. Where not the case, and my wife lived and worked in New Zealand for 2 years as well before we met, so that's both very much sort of the systems we want to run. Yeah, I think that was one of the main things was the scale, the stock being outside all year round, lambing, calving outside. You don't see a lot of cows calved outside over here. We've done a few this time, and I think we'll try and carve them all outside in the future. And then also the work-life balance, I think that hit home quite a lot. They did appreciate time off and time with their family. And the day we'd finished harvest in Australia, everyone just went off to the beach with their families for a week or two. Don't think you always get that here. There's always another job. Everyone loves to think that they're busy in this country. It's almost a bit of a stigma that if you're not busy or working hard, and like your mates will take the piss out of you for going on holiday and things like that because you're not working. Whereas didn't seem to get that over there.
I would
I think that was one.
say that it is a farmer thing, though. I think you feel guilty for it, but
Yeah.
it's. Do you reckon? So you're like cows and ewes. Did you see? So when did they start lambing and calving outside? Did you see? Do you think there was any difference in their ability to do that with it being a bit more extensive compared to how they had previously been done? Or did you buy in those animals when you started doing that?
We bought actually a really good story. We were really lucky. Went down to Norfolk and bought our first 200 clean ewes off Richard and Sue Evans in Norfolk. But we actually went, this was one of the things that really gave us a step up in our farming career. We went down and only had enough money to buy 100. And we looked at them and we liked them all. And Richard very kindly said, "Just take them all and pay me for the other 100 when you can." But he already lambed outside. He's a pretty good forward-thinking farmer, so they were already run very extensively and lambed outside. And he does a lot of cygnet recording, performance recording. So we sort of carried that on as well after we took them off him. And that was very kind of him and was a massive step up to us. And he actually also introduced us to the Nellises up here who got the farm. So that's just another example of networking. So because he encouraged us to join the Performance Recorded Clin group, and there's a lot of really good farmers in that are all performance recording their flocks. And I think everybody in that, or nearly everybody in that, lambs outside and runs good systems. So we've always sourced genetics from the Performance Recorded Clin group and sort of purposely picked rams that have been born outside off extensive systems like we've wanted to run. And on the cattle side, the cows that we took on here, they did used to have a few calving problems and cesareans, but they were not really looking at the EBVs, and some of the bulls they had were bagged calving figures. So we started sourcing bulls that were being born outside and with good calving values. We've got a good friend up at Alnwick, George Burrell, who has some really good, a really good extensive Angus herd, about 200, 250 cows, all calve outside. And he's selling about 40, 45 bulls a year. So just, I think we'll probably just keep getting them off him going forward and move into that system as we get more of it into ours and start calving everything outside. And that more extensively as well. And I also think the massive difference for us this year was when they used to sit in the shed for 6 months all winter, and then you expect them to calve at the end of that. They're not moving around, they're sat on the straw all day, then they get up and eat. And I don't think they sort of somehow have the muscle and the strength as much to push them out. Whereas I think us having them out all winter, and then we brought them in the week before we started calving in March, I think that helped massively with them calving. We only calved 3 out of 100 this year, and compared to what, didn't do any night checks. We'd sort of go and have a look 8, 9 o'clock at night, then come out and check them at 6 o'clock in the morning, whereas they used to check them every 2, 3 hours right through the night here before we took it on. And a lot of people in this country have calving cameras and monitor them all the time. And you can get like a moo call that goes on the tail that texts you when they're calving and whatnot. A lot of things like that that people in Australia and New Zealand probably think was insane.
Well, I think I don't know. So it's so I'm up right this minute up in Katherine in the Northern Territory. So I'm surrounded by massive cattle stations with thousands and thousands and thousands of head of cattle. And so there is no calving intervention. But I feel like it does reflect that, the most extensive, probably the most extensive system of farming in the world, huge pastoral properties, and you bring your cattle in a few times a year, really. But you would reflect on your calving rates. Whereas, and at home, our sheep, well, we have ultra white Staubers, and I could never imagine. So, all shedding sheep, similar to what, yeah, easy, similar to EasyCare use, we're moving towards not tail docking, don't crutch, don't shear. So, we try and do the most minimum amount of work possible with our sheep. They have to be fairly self-sufficient to survive. And yeah, so and but even with lambing, it's a tricky thing. I've had this conversation in a previous interview too. We even like intervention at all. Farmers are hesitant in Australia because they're like, oh, it's out in the paddock. Me assisting that one ewe might disturb the rest, because they're just not as quiet as your guys over there. You're not handled as often. So sometimes it's just like, I don't even know if I will intervene. Like some farmers don't. I do, I personally, we do, but others don't. Like it's a toss up. They're like, oh, I'll disturb the rest of the mob, affect the lambs and ewes. So it is just so different. But also within Australia, it's so varying. But like, when you're saying performance recording, were you talking about like electronic tags?
Yeah, so we at birth at the minute, we're catching everything sort of like once the navel's dry, say 12 hours a day old, just catching them in the field, and ringing them and tagging at birth. And Some like the nucleus, the main flock will get all parentage and everything like that and record it right through and do 8 week weights and weaning weights and ewe weights and body condition.
Yeah.
And the main thing I like doing that is because we keep a lot of our rams. So the a lot of our own rams, any ram that we keep for ourselves will be born outside, or be a twin. Born unassisted in the first cycle, so in the first 17 to 19 days. And I'll put a breeding tag in that, and then that'll be part of the selection for rams we either keep for ourselves or to sell to other people. And anything else, single, triplet, has to be an assisted at birth, or mum's not got a good job, we'll put a ring on it and castrate it. And I think that's a pretty big thing for us. And then yeah, the so it's a legal requirement for EID tags over here, but I think the rule is either as they leave the farm or at 6 months of age, everything has to have an electronic tag in it. But we do it from birth. But a lot of people, well, not a lot, some people before here, they would just tag them with a slaughter tag as they went on the lorry, as they went to the abattoir or the market. And you can get two types of tags. Like the slaughter tags just have a one tag, and anything for breeding has two tags, like a coloured tag and an EID tag, which is a pretty good management tool for us, really. So anything we want to keep, we'll just put a breeding tag in it. And anything we don't that goes to the abattoir, we'll just put a singular slaughter tag in it.
Yeah, we're just EIDs are going to be mandatory in WA or electronic tags in the coming years. So I'm interested to hear what other sheep farmers are doing with their data, just because that's, yeah, like a new thing for us, really.
Yeah, some people, I mean, we've actually started to do a little bit less just because we've got more scale now, but I like to do them from birth. And then as we have a Prattley auto drafter with an XR5000 on it, and as they come in through that, it tells you daily live weight gain and it helps with management decisions. I think we're going to start this year just worming anything that's doing under 200 grams a day. Rather than worming the whole mob, we'll just worm anything that's not performing well, and sort of helps you to see what they're gaining as they're coming through, because it helps with decisions like when you would sell them or when we would keep them. Like if we've not got a lot of grass in front of us and they're not doing a lot of day live weight gain, we will just maybe sell them as stores, or we might think these need a move or something different, or a cobalt jab, or I think it just really helps to make decisions. Yeah.
What made you choose the Prattley?
Really like, so the one we've got runs off a battery rather than a compressor, so it's a lot quieter. And I mean, now it just stays in the sheep pens, but when we were spread around everywhere, it was a lot easier to move around rather than having to have a compressor everywhere. And yeah, it works well. It's a good piece of kit. It does the job for us. Yeah.
Was that something you were able to get with a subsidy? It was.
Yeah, we did. We got that on a grant. We got 40% grant on that. Yeah.
It's good. Yeah. No, that's fascinating, how that works as well over there. That's, yeah, really, really interesting. So regulations over there, Clarkson's Farm, it's done some incredible things, I think, in getting people interested in farming in the UK.
Yeah, so I think the Clarkson's Farm program has been really good. I enjoyed it, and I think he discussed some good issues that are genuine issues in farming, but also made it fun and good for the public to watch. And I think it will have created some good awareness. When we had our friends Keith come and stay with us from New Zealand the other week, Eric came round the farm with me, which was really good to have him round, because he gave us a lot of good suggestions and stuff that they, because they're sheep and beef farmers over there, of what they do. But he was also just amazed by the amount of footpaths we had on the farm. Like, he'd be checking cattle and sheep, and someone would be walking through and be like, "What are they doing? What are they doing?" And Yeah, I think, like you were saying about the extensive systems over there, I think there's only, you're sort of restricted to how extensive you can be here. Like, we lamb everything outside, but we're doing 4 rounds a day at the minute. We do a morning check at 6 o'clock. Then we do like another check after breakfast, or after breakfast, before dinner, somewhere in there. Then an afternoon one. Then we'll go back out after tea, like 6, 7 o'clock, and just check them at night, because you just can't have like dead things or things struggling lying around for people to see, and animal welfare and whatnot. And whilst Eric and Lindsay were over here, we had a barbecue with a few friends from around. And just whilst they were here, like 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, one of the other farmers nearby got a phone call. Someone telling him that he'd walked through their field and one of the lambs was lame. And Eric from New Zealand just couldn't believe that. But it's so common every year. You just get people either knocking on your door, or putting a picture on Facebook saying this sheep's on its own, or so. You do have to be aware that the public are watching, and at the end of the day, the public are your customers. So you have to be seen doing a good job to them.
What,
Yeah.
when something does die, how do you go, where do you take it? So for us, and it seems like a random question, we just have like a home grave, or we let it break down in the paddock because our paddocks are that big. You know, that's.
That was another thing that they were, because they just had a big hole that they dug in the ground and got rid of. But we have a fallen stock collection. So I actually just rang them this morning before this. So you ring them up and then they'll come and collect it. And I think it's incinerated, and maybe they take the hinds off it as well and sell them. So they've actually just put their prices up on the 1st of June. So it costs us £17 to get rid of a ewe.
Yeah.
And is it like £50 a cow?
Post-mortem everything and tell you why it's died, or it's that's literally just for collection.
Yeah, not normally. Usually that's just collection and they're gone. But we're very lucky that at our abattoir, he's called Ben Strugnell, and he runs a post-mortem thing out there. So we pay, it's about £30 a month, and he will post-mortem everything, every sheep we have, if we want. Some
The
things I'll
abattoir
say.
too. So all of your lambs, everything gets a post-mortem.
No, just the dead stock,
Oh,
sorry.
just the dead stuff. Oh, okay. I was gonna say that would be real cool in the abattoir if your lambs, you know, they check the rumen for you, see if there's any, if your feed's right, or you know, have a look.
Yeah, they do. In the abattoir, they'll let you know if they've had like liver fluke or something like that, or maybe worms. But yeah, Ben just post-mortems all of our dead sheep, which is actually really handy. That was how we figured out we had the OPA. And yeah, it is handy. Because I think you have homuncus worms in Australia. Is that one of your main worms?
Yes, we do have all different worms among us. I'll just Google it because we would have a different term.
Yeah. So we found a case of homuncus worm on the farm last year, and that was Ben that found that as well. So it is a
Oh, yeah, we call it rote worm. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting.
That's not that common in this country, but it's getting worse. It started off down south where it's warmer, but it is working its way up the country, and we had a case of it last year, so we're just monitoring that and seeing if it comes back again. But we had good results with a yellow wormer with it, so it's fairly easily controllable, but you get huge egg counts in such a short space of time, so just have to be careful. I mean, hopefully we don't see it too much, because it was just in one paddock and we've put cows in there this time, so hopefully we're on top of it. But it's just something we have to think about, because we didn't have that on our old farm either, so it's just another sort of thing that cropped up with moving farms.
Oh, no, that's, I don't know. So it sounds like there's been a lot of challenges in shifting farm then.
Yeah, I think it affects a flock of sheep more than you realize, actually, moving them 3 hours away in a different, we're higher than we were. We weren't very high above sea level at all where we used to be, whereas here we're sort of 700 to 900 feet above sea level. So that's a bit of a, it's a bit of a different climate for them here, but
It's so fascinating compared to Australia. Like, I could not imagine someone walking through our property. Like, it's bad enough people on the roads, driving around the outside. And the worst, I think, any sheep farmer would say it is their own neighbor, because you love to tell your neighbor when the other sh your ne neighbor's sheep are out. But
yeah.
it's like a bit of a thing, I think. But I could not imagine people walking through. And I suppose with you farming extensively, there is, if we like it or not, that the consumer, the general public, there is more of an interest in welfare of animals. But you're not in barns. Is that a bit of a problem? Is that a conversation over there? I feel like in one of the previous episodes, we talked about like the stigma around them being in barns for a long period of time. So is that another consideration for you wanting to be more extensive?
Not really, because I suppose it's personal opinion, but I sort of think it's nicer for them to be outside. But I suppose some people might think they're maybe cozy in a shed in winter, but we sort of think it's nice for them to be outside, and I think people like to see them outside. We do get, we've not had it a bit, but I know other friends that out winter cattle, you do get people say, oh, it's muddy, if you get a wet spell, like we're moving them every day, but if you get a wet spell whilst they're on that day, they can get muddy before they get another shift. But I think it's education. You've just got to sort of say to them, oh, they're moving every day, they'll be on a fresh bit tomorrow. They've got, just got, people don't always understand.
Oh, and we're fortunate to like know what we know, to have grown up in the life that we have. Do you think people walking through your farm and having the ability to ask all those questions, they have a bit better of an understanding, say, compared to Australia?
I don't, yeah. May I think there's becoming less of a connection. I think, my parents' sort of era, everyone would, well, not everyone, but quite a lot of people rurally would have an uncle or a cousin or somebody that worked on a farm, or like their granddad or someone might have been a farmer, whereas there's a very small percentage of the population feeding the rest of the population now. So it's just getting more and more distanced. And I think we need to improve that. There's a thing over here called FaceTime Farmer where you can join with a school and you do a Zoom call with a class every month to sort of educate them and show what you're doing. And we've not started it yet, but we've just signed up to do that, and our neighbour does it, and a couple of other people I know. And I think things like that will help. But we're lucky on this farm. We're very rurally, but where we were before, we weren't far from a built-up area, and we used to get dog attacks and things like that on footpaths with people with dogs off leads. And if you are near a big city or town, there's a lot of people in that that don't understand and don't have a clue what you're doing at all, really. So it does make life harder. Like even on this farm, where the footpaths are, even though they're not overly used, it does change your decisions. Like, with rotational grazing or bale grazing or strip grazing, you can't just put an electric fence over a footpath and block that. So you've always got to be thinking about which way you're going to put the fences, or if you have to put a temporary gate in, or do it on a different angle to what you were going to do, or just do a different field. If one's got one right through from one corner to the other, maybe just won't do it in there. And so it does affect your farming decisions, definitely.
Just another thing to take into account, I suppose,
Yeah.
that we aren't just so unaware of here in Australia.
Yeah, well, in it, and it, the funny thing is, the UK, there's such different rules, like locally, like Scotland has right to roam, it's called. So people can walk anywhere they want because they have the right to roam around. They don't even have to be on the footpath. Northern Ireland, Will, who's on the NSA, he was telling me last time that they don't have footpaths in Northern Ireland, but we do in England, Wales, and Scotland. And even going back to like these the schemes and the payments, they're different in all of them. Like Scotland, we're only 32 miles off the boundary, and Scotland are not, their payment hasn't declined. They're still getting the full payment, and they also get a sutler calf payment. I think they get about £100 a calf, which we don't get. And it's different in Scotland, England, Wales, and Ireland. Even though we're all so close, there's different rules for everyone. And I think Scotland have got their payment till 2027, and it might go down after that. But they're saying 70% after that. But it's just strange how you so close. You can have someone. I imagine there's someone that probably has land either side of the border, and
There would be
that'll
surely.
take quite managing for them.
No, I don't know. It's so fascinating to hear. And it sounds like you're getting a lot out of the program, though, like being able to network with all of the different farmers from the different areas.
Yeah, I think that's probably my favorite thing about it. There's some really good lads and some really good girls in it that it's just interesting to see what they're all doing and hear their stories. And there's actually quite a lot of new entrants in that as well. So it's interesting to see them stories, and there's some good people in it that I'm sure will go far as well. So it's good just bouncing ideas off each other.
To one of my last questions is why, obviously, you mentioned your parents were on a farm, but why do you want to be part of the ag industry? Why do you want to be a farmer? Why are you doing all of this?
I think initially I just love working with livestock, and I like being outside. And then now I just really like the continual cycle and the challenge of trying to do better next year or doing better every year. And I also really like the peers and the other farmers and people you meet in it. Like we have some fantastic neighbours and friends around here. We had a barbecue about 3 weeks ago and had a load of our neighbors, farmers over, and it's great crack. And I think there's some real good people in the industry, and I sort of enjoy the lifestyle of it and being outside and go to a lot of different groups and things like this NSA thing. And we're part of a grazing group and a lot of different networking things like that. And I think that's one of the main things I enjoy.
And what do you reckon? What are you envisioning? We talked about the challenges the industry's facing, but what do you think is the future of the industry has in store for you guys over there?
Yeah, hopefully our goal is to just keep expanding. I'd like to think sort of a 10, 20-year goal. We would go from 2,000 sheep to 4,000, 6,000, something like that. And I think that would be probably maybe need that as well going forward. Like machinery is getting more and more expensive, and you sort of need a tractor whether you have 500 sheep or 5,000 sheep, and just spreading those sort of fixed costs over more numbers. I think the biggest challenge for us with that, with not owning a farm or being a generational farmer, is capital. It can be hard to, there's a lot of money involved in farming, and it's can be hard to gain or source that capital without having anything to borrow it against, except from the stock. So I think that'll probably be our challenge going forward. We always see a lot of opportunities. There was a farm came up not too far away recently, and we looked at that, and we just sat down, did a few basic sums, and thought we're going to need to borrow 400,000 to start renting this. And we didn't think we'd be able to get that, and didn't really want the stress of it at the minute till we've got this farm properly sorted out. So we didn't bother putting in for that. But hopefully in the future, once we're more stocked up with this farm, we can look at another one. I think we're making good progress with this farm now. We've sort of getting it the way we want it and improving it. So once we've got this one sorted out, we're quite ambitious. We'll quite just keep looking for the next opportunity, I think.
No, thank you. Is there anything else you'd think sheep farmers around the world should know, or anyone else?
Not that I can think of.
Oh, thank you so much for your time. I don't know, I find it so interesting. And you guys will have to come over to Western Australia and come and have a look at our shedding flock and very extensively run sheep enterprise, because it sounds like there's a lot more in common than what I thought. Yeah, between the two systems.
Yeah, I'd enjoy that. I think that's definitely where we're aiming to go.
Yeah. No, well, thank you so much for your time.
No, you're welcome. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rich. Once again, an incredible story. We have more episodes lined up chatting to the young sheep farmers part of this series from around the world. Or if you know someone who has a story that you think should be heard, please don't hesitate to reach out.